Anna likely made some connections with the small black community of some 162 households in Rochester. All was not sour in the Douglases' marriage. That summer they conceived their fifth child. In a personal reminiscence written in 1917, the youngest son, Charles, recalled a rosy, sentimental homestead at Alexander Street, where he and his brothers attended common schools, but were increasingly taken from school one day in each week to deliver the paper to local subscribers or to learn typesetting. Charles believed the North Star survived as a collective family enterprise. To maintain this paper, every effort was put forth by every member of the family to keep it alive. But life on Alexander Street and getting out the paper on Buffalo Street were much more complex matters. Douglas never had enough money in these years, and would soon have to mortgage his house again to pay his staff at the newspaper. In late April, he wrote to Julia Griffiths that he was struggling to find the bright side of the future. He worried openly that he might have undertaken more than I have the ability to perform. He feared he had miscalculated the amount of support which would be extended to my enterprise. In this cry for help, Douglas complained that Delaney had not done enough to raise subscriptions, leaving the editor alone doing everything. He confessed that he had expended more than the sum sent me from England and shall require $60 per week for 6 months to come in order to keep my paper afloat. Douglas dearly needed help. Griffiths, who wrote to him frequently and sent him leading British newspapers, heard his cry. She visited him in Rochester for a short time later that fall, steadied his spirits, and a year later, in May 1849, making an extraordinary commitment, relocated to America and helped the North Star and Frederick himself survive into the 1850s. Douglas's maintenance of an equilibrium amid all these pressures of home and his own ambition defied the odds. In part, he managed from month to month because of Anna's steadfast care for the children and the hearth. She was his ultimate helpmeet, as he admitted many times. The family stood waiting there on each of his homecomings, and the North Star was theirs as well. Douglas sustained his inner psychological standing in part by the sheer force of will and what he called his pen and tongue. That he managed to keep the North Star alive through those first years is a testament to his stamina and his growing felicity with the short essay. He had established himself as a world-class orator, but the newspaper now became his reason to be. The North Star shall live or must be sustained, he would often say, not as a mere expression of business enterprise, but for his own sheer existence. The paper became, as he later recalled, the motive power of his life. Douglas tested his ideas and began to grasp the landscape of politics through the lens of the North Star. It was the best school possible for me, he wrote. It obliged me to think and read. It taught me to express my thoughts clearly. He had to produce the words that were both burden and liberation. I had an audience to speak to every week and must say something worth their hearing or cease to speak altogether. Douglas relished what he called his editor's sting of necessity, and his evolving voice became both more pragmatic and more radical as it became more political. That summer of 1848, Douglas made one of his big strides into the politics of reform by supporting women's rights and participating at the Seneca Falls Convention on July 19th through 20th. The idea for such a convention had long brewed among feminists and women's rights advocates. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who lived in Seneca Falls, and a group of Quaker women gathered around Mary Ann McClintock and her two daughters, Mary Ann and Elizabeth, in Waterloo, New York, along with the skillful aid of Lucretia Mott, put out a call for a convention in the Seneca County Courier on July 11th. Douglas responded immediately by running the appeal in the North Star on July 14th. Some 300 people attended the two-day historic assembly in the Wesleyan Methodist Chapel of Seneca Falls. Douglas eagerly joined his Rochester friend, Amy Post, at the convention. The gathering was largely local, with attendees coming mainly from the upstate region. Some husbands of these women reformers, as well as other male abolitionists, attended, but most did not. Issues of women's place, much less equal rights, had long been lightning rods in the anti-slavery movement in Britain and the United States. But Douglass never exhibited any ambiguity or caution. His many women friends had taught him much. The convention famously produced a Declaration of Sentiments, modeled directly on the Declaration of Independence. With the word women inserted, all men and women are created equal, where appropriate. The more than a dozen resolutions accompanying the document covered all manner of demands for equality in jobs, in courts of law, in family relations, religion, and education. All resolutions passed unanimously, except the controversial claim for the elective franchise. So contested was the issue of voting that many women leaders, such as Lucretia Mott, refused to support it, fearing they would lose the ultimate hope of gaining any rights because of this demand. But during the afternoon debate of the second day's meeting, Douglass forcefully endorsed full women's suffrage, which may have helped win the day in a divided vote. In his North Star report about Seneca Falls, Douglass expressed great pride at participating and called the demands simple justice. He freely admitted that all in favor of women's equality courted ridicule, fury, and bigotry. But he did not equivocate. Civil society had been deprived too long of the labor and talent of half the human family, he said. There can be no reason in the world for denying to women the exercise of the elective franchise. Douglass was the only black person attending the Seneca Falls Convention, and it remained a matter of lifetime pride that he was among the 32 men and 68 women who signed the Declaration of Sentiments. He would always be delighted to be called a women's rights man. The motto on the masthead of the North Star, "Right is of no color and no sex," had been no mere sentiment. Throughout 1848, Douglass took an ever keener interest in national politics, even as he managed still to denounce the corruptions of parties. One Douglass biographer sees the editor's overall North Star prose style as rather solemnly polemical, while another points to his love of irony, humor, and ambiguity, and therefore a prose that sounded more genteel. Neither is wrong, but it is hard to miss how Douglass's journalistic as well as oratorical voice in these years sounded furious and militant as he became more political. His rhetoric carried more Old Testament pain and rage. Jeremiah caught a second wind. He took up the editor's pen to provoke his readers into action. The humor and entertainment of the lecture hall gave way to opinion and the persuasiveness of the editorial. To that person who had called him the demagogue in black, it was as if Douglass responded by saying something like, "Thank you. If you want a demagogue, I will give you a demagogue." His model journalist, after all, was William Lloyd Garrison. Douglass read widely in the national and the British press about the Republican revolutions breaking out all over Europe, especially in France in February and March 1848. He took heart as monarchy and slavery in the French Empire came under assault from a movement of universal egalitarianism. "We live in stirring times and amid thrilling events," he told an audience at a West Indian emancipation celebration in Rochester on August 1st. Brandishing historical detail, he turned a shared identity with the French proletariat back into the atrocious wickedness of American slavery. While Europeans strove to free themselves from centuries of tyranny, Americans could only mouth awkward half-truths of support, and voters could only choose between tyrants and men-stealers to rule over us. In revolutionary times, Douglass concluded, some lives may indeed be lost. In public, he frequently invoked the memory of Nat Turner as a noble slave rebel to compare to the French, Germans, and Italians at their barricades, gunned down in the streets. Douglass now mixed this early embrace of violent means with one of his favorite tactics, heaping blame on white Northerners for their complicity with slavery. In a speech in Faneuil Hall in Boston, he told his friendly auditors, "You are the enslavers of my Southern brethren and sisters." By their participation under the U.S. Constitution, he similarly charged the Rochester throng on August 1st with bringing the bristling bayonets of the whole military power of the nation down on the lives of slaves. Had not Nat Turner, Douglas intoned, only acted with the selfsame means which the Revolutionary Fathers employed? Those Rochester journalists who remarked about the sarcastic tones and the bitterness of Douglas's public rhetoric had heard him loud and clear. Douglas also pulled the story back within the human heart. On September 3, 1848, the 10th anniversary of his escape from slavery, he published a public letter to his former master, Thomas Auld. The letter is a masterpiece of anti-slavery propaganda, as well as an expression of personal rage. Although the missive contained some inaccuracies, especially the accusation that Auld had abandoned Betsy Bailey out to fields to fend for herself or die, which Douglas later had to recant, Auld's former property boldly put his old master to his service. With Auld as his model, Douglas flayed every slaveholder who had ever lifted a lash or sold a human being. This was Douglas's personal symbolic whipping of Auld and an indictment in front of a jury of history. The chosen tool of punishment was the pen. Douglas had many times used Auld as the slaveholder in speeches, especially when exposing the religious hypocrisy of Southern Methodists. Now, Douglas addressed him directly by name and dared him not to listen. The letter is funny, falsely and formally delicate, and at times quite moving. A Douglas biographer has contended that the letter is one of the strangest pieces in the literature of American slavery because of its peculiar distortions. But accuracy is not the best measure of the letter. Douglas sought new recruits for the abolition cause and readers for the North Star. He hit some new notes as he settled some old scores. He played with Auld, offering a justification for invading the proprieties of private life in his former owner's quiet corner of the Eastern Shore. "I will not manifest ill temper by calling you hard names," he assured Auld. But he also made his intent explicit. "I intend to make use of you as a weapon with which to assail the system of slavery." Douglas did flail about a bit, but he landed many reverberating blows. He prompted angry responses to the humiliation of Auld from as far away as a slaveholder in Georgia, who wrote, "As emancipationists, you colored fellows are the worst. As well may the dog claim to be a man as the Negro a free man and equal among those that God designed to be his superior. The order of nature can be as soon reverted to any good in the one case as in the other." In addressing Auld, Douglas lectured him about the natural right to self-ownership. "I am myself. You are yourself. We are two distinct persons, equal persons. What you are, I am. God created both and made us separate beings. I am not by nature bound to you or you to me. Nature does not make your existence depend upon me or mine to depend upon yours." Douglas especially used Auld to demonstrate how far his slave had risen, how he had created a family, how he had made the successful transition from degradation to respectability. He pointed to his comfortable house, his industrious and neat wife, his four dear children, three of whom were in school. Then, by contrast, in the most moving lines of the letter, he wrenched his readers into slavery's domestic heart of darkness. "They, the children, are all in comfortable beds and are sound asleep, perfectly secure under my roof. There are no slaveholders here to rend my heart by snatching them from my arms, or blast a mother's dearest hopes by tearing them from her bosom." Here, Douglas's rage against slavery found its outlet. "Oh, sir, A slaveholder never appears to me so completely an agent of hell as when I think of and look upon my dear children. It is then that my feelings rise above my control. Mercilessly, Douglas dragged Auld back into their shared history with the tides turned. Say not that this is a picture of fancy. You well know that I wear stripes on my back inflicted by your direction, and that you, while we were brothers in the same church, caused this right hand with which I am now penning this letter to be closely tied to my left, and my person dragged at the pistol's mouth 15 miles, from the Bayside to Easton, to be sold like a beast in the market. Douglas avoids how Auld did not sell him south, but sent him back to Baltimore. In 1848, the facts were aligned thus for a reason. A liberated Douglas, man of letters, must still be seen through the lens of the manacled Fred Bailey. He loved the reversal and reworked his story on Auld's back. The letter to Auld was a public humiliation, a symbolic indictment of all the thousands of white slaveholding fathers through the years. Douglas demands to know from Auld whether he had sold his sisters. He even insists that his former owner, imagine Douglas invading Auld's St. Michael's house, kidnapping his own daughter, Amanda, and selling her to the brutal lust of fiendish overseers. Although there was no evidence that Auld had ever broken up families or sold away Frederick's female kin, Douglas used the letter as a defense of the virtue of black womanhood. In Douglas's innuendo about the rape of his mother, and in trading on slavery's sexual nightmares, as well as the mystery of his own paternity, he gave to anti-slavery literature this barely controlled eruption of human rage. The North Star had to get written, edited, and printed every week. The nation's evolving crisis over slavery's expansion in the wake of the Mexican War, and especially the presidential election that fall, had to be explained. Douglas often blurred the lines between his private and public alienation. The demands of succinctness in the columns of the newspaper provided a disciplined retreat for this man of words, barely holding on to an equipoise he only half comprehended. Venting on Auld and blasting the slaveholding nation became one and the same task. In the election of 1848, Douglas supported the new Free Soil Party and its candidate, former President Martin Van Buren. Douglas even attended its convention in Buffalo in September. But he was deeply disappointed by the election of the slaveholder war hero, General Zachary Taylor. In a post-election editorial, "The Blood of the Slave on the Skirts of the Northern People," Douglas Riley apologized if he should seem severe or speak harshly, but he felt 1,000 poisonous stings in his heart as he reflected on the state of the Union. Douglas told white Northern voters that the blood of the slave is on your garments. You have said that slavery is better than freedom, that war is better than peace, and that cruelty is better than humanity. Douglas kept Jeremiah's sword sharpened, addressing the nation as his audience. What mean ye that ye bruise and bind my people? Will justice sleep forever? Repent of this wickedness by delivering the despoiled out of the hands of the despoiler. He refused to extend peace where there was no peace. Douglas signaled hope with the only weapon in his arsenal. Abolition would spring forth, he contended, from the press and on the voice of the living speaker. Words of burning truth to alarm the guilty, to unmask the hypocrite, to expose the frauds of political parties, and rebuke the spirit of a corrupt and sin-sustaining church. Douglas announced, without fully knowing it, the theme of his and the country's life for the next decade. Slavery will be attacked in its stronghold. The compromises of the Constitution and the cry of disunion shall be more fearlessly proclaimed. Till slavery be abolished, the Union dissolved, or the son of this guilty nation must go down in blood. Words that burn. Douglas's stock in trade. He borrowed a page from Nat Turner, as he also strove to honor the principles of Garrison. Ultimately, he could not do both. Soon, Julia Griffiths arrived from England to help him navigate these troubled waters. Chapter 12. My Faithful Friend, Julia. Miss Griffiths is industriously wielding her pen at another desk. Frederick Douglass, May 21st, 1851. By the early 1850s, Frederick Douglass underwent a terrible estrangement from William Lloyd Garrison, experienced an ideological transformation in his view of anti-slavery strategy under the influence of Gerrit Smith, and to a great extent, survived personally and professionally because of his friendship with Julia Griffiths. It was a time of loss and new imaginings, private despair, and a new public political purpose for his life. As usual, although with new extremes, he was under attack. "Let no man hope to succeed in insulting me," Douglass announced on May 7, 1850, in his speech at the annual meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society in New York. This most turbulent gathering the old organization had ever held occurred during the intense debate in Washington, D.C. over the Compromise of 1850 and its notorious Fugitive Slave Act. Fear for the Union and social order, as well as racist resistance to black assertions of civil liberty and to abolitionism, flowed into the Broadway Tabernacle where the activists met. Some New York papers, especially the Democratic Party organ, The Herald, had ginned up great hostility and suggested violence against the AASS in advance of the meetings. As Garrison attempted to deliver the opening address, a mob stormed the platform, yelling, cheering, swearing. They were led by Isaiah Reinders, a notorious gang leader and Tammany Hall boss of the 6th Ward and the Five Points District. Profanely violent and racist, Reinders, born of Irish and German parents in upstate New York, was at the height of his powers in Lower Manhattan streets and faced no resistance from the hapless New York police, who also attended the gathering. Reinders' gangs, known by names such as Plug Uglies or Dead Rabbits, were particularly adept at using clubs, knives, and guns to foment riots on behalf of some Irish interests. Notorious as a sporting man, involved in gambling, horse racing, and boxing, Reinders was, according to one historian, the nation's foremost political thug. But the Bible-quoting Reinders also possessed rhetorical skill at repartee and insult. Oddly, in the spirit of free speech, Garrison and the abolitionists invited the mob to have their say in what became a theater of the absurd. A Mr. Grant, the orator designated by Reinders to speak for the mob, argued that blacks were not human, but part of the monkey species, and that the mixing of blacks and whites at this assembly violated nature and nature's God. Many among the disoriented, pacifist abolitionists began to shout for Douglass to speak. Douglass rose to the call and held forth, although bizarrely with Captain Reinders at his elbow, as the press reported. At first, Douglass walked into Reinders' trap by making himself and racial identity the subject. He complained about Grant's inhumane claims about blacks and appealed to the audience to look at him, Douglass, in the face and at his woolly head and asked, "Am I not a man?" Reinders then made one of his frequent interruptions while standing at Douglass's side. "You are not a black man. You are only half a nigger," fumed the ward boss, to which Douglass replied, causing roars of laughter, "He is correct. I am, indeed, only half a Negro, a half-brother to Mr. Reinders." Douglass gave as he took in this dangerous situation, turning humiliation into humor. Declaring himself from the South and a son of a slaveholder, Douglass suggested that if Reinders wished to preach against amalgamation, He should aim at white men who wrote the laws so they could exploit their female slaves. Speaking as a black man, Douglass dared to challenge my half-brother Rinders and all Irish immigrants who recently landed on these shores, enjoying greater privileges than African Americans. Amidst epithets of mongrels all, Douglass made the case for blacks as older immigrants who had watered the soil with our tears and fertilized it with our blood. Their labor had raised the cotton for the shirts on your backs and produced the sugar that sweetens your coffee. Douglass had long preferred associations with a different sort of Irish, the middle-class reformers and Quakers who had nurtured and adored him in Cork or Dublin. Here, in this grotesque sport of raw American racism and antebellum identity wars, he felt empowered to exhibit his own mind and body in contrast to those of his vicious opponents. "We only want our rights," Douglass pleaded in conclusion. "I care not whether I am descended from a man or a monkey. I have a head to think, and I know God meant I should exercise the right to think. I have a heart to feel and a tongue to speak. And God meant that I should use that tongue in behalf of humanity and justice for every man." But Rinders's thugs had not come for a history lecture. They had no stamina to hear a black man's eloquent complaints. Remarkably, the 2 hours of disruption and confusion ended without violence. Rinders and his mob left the hall with apparent satisfaction that they had lampooned the hated abolitionists and their favored black orator. Douglass, as long as he survived to tell it, seemed to enjoy having Rinders as his foil. And for his part, Rinders later admitted that Douglass's response to him at the anti-slavery meeting was as good a shot as I ever had in my life. Douglass, however, had one more violent humiliation to endure in New York. He attended the AASS meetings in the company of Julia Griffiths and her younger sister, Eliza. Julia had arrived in Rochester in May 1849 for what may have been planned as a permanent stay. For part of a year already, she had been working as the business manager, fundraiser, and assistant editor on the North Star. She lived in Douglass's home, and under her management, the paper had increased in subscriptions and editorial quality. Eliza and John Dick, the printer in the North Star office, also boarded in the Douglass's house. Eliza and John were about to be married and would emigrate to Canada in June 1850. The day after the AASS meetings ended, while awaiting his ferry for an engagement in Philadelphia, Douglass strolled in Battery Park at the lower tip of Manhattan with the Griffiths sisters. Reports conflict about whether they were arm in arm, but according to Douglass, his presence on this fashionable promenade with two white ladies prompted a mob of a half dozen to assault them. Using coarse and filthy language, several of the thugs struck the sisters on the head, while one of them assaulted Douglass. The abolitionist fended them off with his umbrella, and they seemed to disperse, although as the Douglass party neared the steamer dock, one assailant jumped Douglass again and slugged him in the face. The attack soon appeared all over the press, including in London, where the Times reprinted articles from the New York Globe that argued Douglass deserved the attacks, not only for his audacious and disgraceful violation of racial sexual propriety, but for his abusing his country, its patriots, and constitution in recent speeches. According to these versions of the incident, an indignant gentleman had graciously separated Douglass from the white women and given the black man a dressing he deserved. As before, Douglass used this attack for its fullest propaganda value, while revealing a good deal about himself and his relationship with Julia. In his account of the incident, he declared the abuse in New York the most demoniacal he had ever endured. He felt as though he lived in an enemy's land, surrounded on all sides, and he happily pled guilty to all charges, glorying in having committed them, if it meant that the crime was to be a man entitled to all rights, privileges, and dignity, He claimed the right to associate with anyone, including his white female friends, in public places. In editorials, he admitted that his attackers were vicious people, but maintained they served as the appointed bloodhounds of American slavery. Douglas turned the affair into an incisive analysis of racism. His offense, he argued, had never been the companionship with white women, but the assumption of equality with them. America's aristocracy of skin could not tolerate such behavior. He drew deep from 9 years of lecturing and travel, declaring that he could not remember to have made a single anti-slavery tour when he had not been assailed by this mean spirit of caste. Douglas argued that the term prejudice was simply too weak and innocent to capture what blacks endured. A more savage language was required to match the beliefs of all the Reinderses inside and outside of power. Properly speaking, Douglas contended, prejudice against color does not exist in this country. The feeling, or whatever it is, which we call prejudice, is no less than a murderous, hell-born hatred of every virtue which may adorn the character of a black man. Black men were acceptable when appendages, he said. While riding down Broadway in company with ladies, Douglas wrote, they observed several white ladies riding with black servants. Those well-dressed carriage drivers did not offend the hooligans who attacked Douglas and his companions. Douglas relished his impudence. Equality, not color, offended. He had given definition and texture to the idea of racism, and he and Griffiths, daily colleagues in a struggle of head and heart, now had a bold public appearance of violence that cemented their bond. The abiding friendship of Frederick and Julia must be understood within this world of raw, belligerent racism. The handsome and most famous black man in the United States simply would not give in to its power. And he dearly needed the powers and skills that Griffiths brought to his work and life. Unmarried, 7 years older than her host, and raised with deep reform commitments, Griffiths adored both Douglas and his cause. Little is known about Griffiths' early education, but she brought a knowledge of grammar, business acumen, and even political savvy to Douglas's office. Indeed, Douglas gave Griffiths not only acknowledgement for her talents, but for several years he gave her the career this Victorian woman had never achieved. Soon after her arrival in Rochester in May 1849, she wielded a blue pencil on the editor's copy as she chastised the printers and their boss alike for the North Star's misspellings and errors. Whether their connection had ever been love at first sight, as some have suggested, is speculation. She did write a song in honor of Douglas's departure from England, Farewell to Frederick Douglass, which was published in London in 1847. But Griffiths was no mere starry-eyed devotee. She was a manager of business affairs, as well as of people. She was a voracious reader and learner. Her devotion to radical abolitionism provided what the movement often desperately needed: astute organization, financial foundation, and an apparently pure commitment to help Douglas go out and be Douglas. She soon composed a regular column for the newspaper, literary notices, signaling new books and magazines available at a local bookstore. She possessed a wide knowledge of literature, classical and popular. Griffiths also had a hand in some editorials, and many times helped get the weekly paper out in the editor's absence. No matter how awkward things became for Anna and the children at the house in Rochester, the North Star's editor was all too glad to have Julia as a daily colleague. This extraordinary and ultimately untenable situation of an educated white Englishwoman living in the Douglas home and laboring daily with him on his life's work, while Anna Douglas raised 5 children in its midst, leads us to wonder whether the relationship was ever sexual. We do not know for sure, and perhaps it does not matter. The tenderness of their associations and correspondence, and the intimacy with which Julia seems to have nurtured her younger hero might lead us moderns to assume that, of course, they slept with each other. But right under the watchful eyes and immediate presence of Anna? Not likely. They already violated norms of appearance, whether they shared a bed or not. Griffith's intelligence and deep caring were surely attractive to Frederick. Their mutual affection did not need to be sexual to be fulfilling, at least for Frederick. When Isaac Post met Julia, he described her as older than he expected. Samuel J. May called her an ordinary-looking white woman, although the famed British abolitionist George Thompson, upon his visit and fate with 50 guests at Douglas's house in 1851, made no notice of Anna, while observing that he had a pleasant evening irradiated by the mild splendor of a certain Julia. Frederick and Julia's quite public acknowledgement of a close working relationship implies that they kept things as proper as possible. Julia played many roles at the homestead, including unsuccessful attempts at tutoring Anna in literacy and some care of the younger children. Julia provided many things Anna did not: intellectual companionship and challenge, a female face toward the public when he needed it, and a nurturing that the struggling 30 to 35-year-old Douglas desperately needed. Julia served a practical end as well. She raised a good deal of money that fed his family and kept the newspaper afloat. Indeed, in August 1849, during the full year that both Julia and Eliza boarded with the Douglases on Alexander Street, they purchased with their own money the mortgage on the house, relieving Frederick and Anna of a huge worry. By 1850, like it or not, Anna and the family depended on Julia's presence. Douglas had already struck up a strong relationship with Gerrit Smith, the wealthy upstate New York abolitionist, before Julia arrived on the scene. But she helped cultivate that crucial connection, both financially and ideologically. In the summer of 1850, in one of her letters to Smith about the dire straits of the North Star, Griffiths reminded the philanthropist of her key role. "Remember, dear sir, I am the banker for the paper, and know always precisely how the accounts stand." That is far more than Douglas could ever say on his own. Julia helped to polish a raw genius into a gem, and, for a time, managed his emotional health as well as his bank accounts. Gerrit Smith was a man of enormous emotional complexity, religious fervor, anti-slavery commitment, and wealth. By 1850, he had put aside long-standing ties to old colonizationists, then to Garrisonian moral suasion, as well as the temperance movement, and embraced political abolitionism. Along the way, he was even a Millerite for a while, adopting the millennialist William Miller's predictions of Christ's second coming in 1843. Smith had been raised in the mansion house of his father, Peter Smith, in Peterborough, New York. Peter, an uneducated man and cold father, had amassed great wealth as a land baron in upstate New York, traded with Indian tribes such as the Oneida, and held numerous slaves, with whom his sons worked side by side until the Panic of 1819. As a young intellectual, Gerrit sought an education at Hamilton College in Clinton, New York, and fashioned himself a romantic Byronic hero who would become a man of letters. Smith never gave up entirely on his literary aspirations, even after he inherited and reluctantly took over his father's huge estate. Always susceptible to wild mood swings, Smith underwent a variety of religious conversions. First, after the death of his beloved mother and his first wife, named Welta, within a year of their marriage in 1819. And again in the 1820s and 1830s, as religious revivals spread through the region. By the time Douglas and Smith connected after the orator's move to Rochester, the sage of Peterborough had established a circle of followers who would use political institutions, the Constitution, and the vote to try to crush the slave power in the United States. Douglas, long chafing under Garrisonian strictures and open to new ideas, found Smith's overtures toward political action, the Liberty Party, and an anti-slavery interpretation of the Constitution, irresistible. From the beginning, Douglas and Smith engaged in an increasingly intense correspondence. Julia's interventions now enhanced the two distinct dimensions of this friendship, the one practical and pecuniary, and the other intellectual and strategic. Smith was an early supporter of the North Star, but as Douglas struggled to keep the paper alive in the spring of 1849, he groused about being broke to the man with deep pockets. "My money is now all gone," the editor reported. He was at least $200 in debt. Douglas declared himself out on a limb. His best friends, Garrisonians, thought his venture unnecessary and useless. He had started the paper against their wishes. Douglas eagerly courted the donor. As Smith responded by sending small checks, he also aggressively recruited Douglas to the cause of political abolition. Smith's new protege would take most of a year to fully give in to the new ideology. All the while, Griffiths revved up the fundraising and saved Douglas from bankruptcy and psychological collapse. The neighborhood and most of Reform Rochester was all astir over the fascinating Englishwomen living in Douglas's home. The spinsters of means and culture caused endless curiosity in the city, according to a chronicler of Rochester. A reminiscence published in 1941 quaintly captures the way the locals observed the situation. "The appearance on the main street," wrote Howard Coles, "of Frederick Douglass, with one of these ladies on either arm, seriously threatened the order of the town for a while, and threats were openly made of what would be done if such aggressive demonstrations of race mixture were persisted in. Frederick Douglass kept his head high as ever, the ladies filling the role of possible martyrs unflinchingly. In reality, Julia simply went to work, although she and Frederick understood the order they challenged." Along with anti-slavery, Douglas became Griffith's cause. The best windows we have into their relationship, as well as into Douglas's mental and physical health, are the remarkable letters Julia wrote to Gerrit Smith. She frequently depicted Frederick as psychologically distraught over the plight of the paper and the financial situation of his family, as well as physically incapacitated, not only by constant throat ailments, but by what she called inflammatory rheumatism. At the age of 32 to 33, Douglas was sometimes confined to bed for days at a time, his joints locked up, limbs swollen, unable to walk. In the summer of 1850, Julia reported him quite sick with a grave attack of this debilitating condition. "In the course of the last fortnight, he has had three severe falls," Julia confided to Smith. The reports were remarkably intimate. "He has a good man who comes twice a day to wash him." By autumn, Julia asked Smith to keep all this knowledge strictly private, as she described Douglas's bad cough and lightheadedness. Julia proudly announced that she wrote the editorials as her comrade dictated. Then, at night, he was seized with a fit and has been laid up with his throat ever since. Already by the 1850s, Douglas's public image was of a virile man of the world, holding audiences in rapt control with words as well as charisma. His baritone voice alone, coupled with authentic slave roots, mesmerized his audiences. Increasingly, he sat for, as well as manipulated, many photographers who captured his unforgettable visage frontally and in profile, erect, with starched shirts, exuding intelligence and greatness. The fiery eyes, prominent nose, striking features, goatee surrounding prominent lips seemingly about to burst into eloquence, and that lion's mane of hair, carefully brushed and parted, all provided an image of a man for a heroic age. But this was not the man undergoing some sort of paralysis and nervous breakdown by 1851. The reports of Douglas's illnesses were so common that Smith wrote back to Griffiths in July, "much grieved to hear of the continued sickness of our dear Douglas." That same month in the paper, she publicly announced that the editor underwent a severe relapse of his illness and was wholly unable to write for the present number. A week later, Douglas himself described his condition, verifying what had appeared in Griffith's letters. He suffered from a succession of attacks, he declared, for a full month. First, bilious fever, sharp, sudden, and severe, brought on no doubt by overexertion and incautious exposure, prostrated my energies and confined me to my room. For 5 years, he admitted, these maladies, lodged in his throat difficulty, had plagued him. When back on his feet, Douglas rushed out on speaking tours to raise money for the newspaper. He was frantically trying to make ends meet, feed his family, and, as he said in the paper, keep heads above water. Julia's most disturbing reports indicated that Douglas floated in and out of mental collapse. In late July 1851, he was quite unwell, one day able to work at the office, and the next two unfit for it. Although the seat of the disease is the throat, she said, I'm inclined to think that serious anxiety for his paper has much to do with it. By late August, the great man was extremely depressed because little money flowed into the coffers, a dire circumstance especially since Frederick possessed a perfect horror of being in debt. Julia tried to inspire him with hope, but often to no avail. The alarm in her letters came embedded in constant appeals for money from Smith. Indeed, without Smith's donations, $100 here and $200 there, Douglas's paper would have folded. Anna kept an excellent vegetable garden, but Smith's largesse not only paid for the North Star's printing, ink, and paper bills, but it provided food for 5 growing children. And the stress in the household was enormous. We have not had sickness out of the house for a single day since the end of June, Julia reported in August. All this naturally tends to depress our friend greatly, added to which he has recently had a considerable increase of those house trials about which I spoke to you and dear Mrs. Smith when at Peterborough. Julia, not Anna, had accompanied Douglas on a social visit to the Smiths' mansion earlier that month. House trials? Julia did not offer a definition, but we can surmise that this meant not only money stresses, and the demands of children needing their father's attention. It surely meant quarrels with Anna, whose considerable homemaking powers were held hostage to the success or failure of the enterprise Julia ran for her husband, day and night. Douglas was a women's rights man, but privately he struggled mightily with his sense of manliness in these years. He had never known a father who took care of him, but he was failing. He could go out and thrill an audience, but at home, he was the patriarch who could not provide for his family. In the myth of the self-made man burgeoning all over the culture in antebellum America, and of which Douglas became a famous proponent, this archetype had to publicly prove, as the sociologist Michael Kimmel argues, that he mastered his life, liberty, and property. In the psyche of every self-made man roiled a nightmare of chronic insecurity in the volatile marketplace. Manhood required mobility and independence, and it also courted catastrophe. Griffiths remembered Douglas saying that soon, if his financial situation did not improve, he would be digging potatoes. So embarrassed was Douglas that Griffiths's frequent appeals to Smith for money were something he would simultaneously deny he needed, as he also begged for more. He wrote many direct appeals in his newspaper to delinquent subscribers to pay up and demonstrate their pride in an enterprise owned and edited by a former fugitive slave. Douglas felt the double-edged sword of denial. Sometimes he pushed through its confusions and admitted it. In September 1851, he wrote to Smith, regretting that you should be so soon called upon for a helping hand. The calls that year never stopped. Necessity, my friend, would listen to no regrets, Douglas admitted. I was under the hammer, and my friend, Julia, seeing it, cried out in my behalf. You came to my help, and I am on my feet again. Well, not really. In November, in another letter labeled Private, Julia communicated her frightful apprehension about Douglas's psychological state. He suffered immense anxiety, pecuniary and family, and one evening seemed to lose his balance of mind, wandering around murmuring about going crazy. She sat up late at night with him singing and reciting repeated hymns and psalms, and an old favorite Robert Burns poem, The Cotter's Saturday Night. The melancholy love poem contains this verse. O happy love, where love like this is found. O heartfelt raptures, bliss beyond compare. I've paced much this weary mortal round, and sage experience bids me this declare. If heaven a draught of heavenly pleasure spare, one cordial in this melancholy vale, 'tis when a youthful, loving, modest pair in others' arms breathe out the tender tale beneath the milk-white thorn that scents the evening gale. Performing as a bonny lass in a Burns poem, Julia concluded, I shall do all in my power to tranquilize him, and shall not feather my fears to anyone. But that hardly mattered. Douglas pronounced for all his readers by December 1851 that he was again extremely unwell. He did travel to Providence to deliver one unusual lecture in which he bared his spiritual soul. I have been for the past year under a cloud. He called for abolitionists to pray and meditate and foster love. He openly worried that by so long lambasting the clergy in his slaveholder's sermon, he had destroyed in myself that very reverence for God and for religion. His illnesses had been so disabling, he declared, that for compiling my paper, the credit is due to my friend, Miss Griffiths. Douglas was at risk of total psychological collapse. Anna and Julia were two different kinds of companions. As Rosetta remembered, Anna possessed no knowledge of books and did not participate in Douglas's frenzied activism. A Rochester local history laden with reminiscences deemed Anna a model housekeeper with severe notions of the proprieties and duties of life. Her greatest discontent, said the Rochesterite, was when admirers of her husband persisted in dragging her into notice to receive visitors. Calling Julia the business manager and special friend, however, is not enough. It was as though Douglas had a conjugal and a companionate mate, and they were not the same person. Exactly how he justified or explained this to himself or to Anna, he never tells us. One woman provided him a home and a family. The other helped him forge his professional life and calling. He loved both. Douglas commonly signed off a letter to Gerrit Smith in the manner he did in May 1851. I write from the office, or I am sure that my wife would unite with Miss Griffiths, who is industriously wielding her pen at another desk, in sending love to you and your dear lady. Douglas constantly called attention to Griffiths's assiduous labors at his side. As the plan solidified by June 1851, to combine Smith's fledgling Liberty Party paper with the North Star in a new venture renamed Frederick Douglass's paper, the editor let his benefactor know that he was not working alone. Julia Griffiths, my faithful friend and co-worker, he assured Smith, to whom I am greatly indebted for many lessons of wisdom, is all zeal in our new enterprise. Repeatedly, Douglas acknowledged his dependence on Griffiths's energy and ideas. As they planned the launch of the new paper, the editor said, "Money matters should be left to the care of my industrious and vigilant friend and co-worker, Julia Griffiths. With her eye on the subscription list, I think very little would go wrong in that quarter." Douglas openly worried about Julia as he exalted her to Smith, implying that her situation, living in such proximity to Anna and his family, caused her great strain. "To her, the credit belongs that the Star is now out of debts," he wrote. "She ought to have this credit, for you need not be told that she has much to annoy and at times weigh down her spirit. She feels happy at the prospect now before her, and will doubtless enter upon her duties with much spirit." Douglas thus admitted the tensions among the women in his own household, as well as his own dire needs. Few statements survive from this period in which he expresses similar concern for Anna's emotional well-being. Douglas cherished the co-worker at his side in the office and the nursemaid in the depths of his depressions and illnesses. She gave him confidence and psychic ballast. Julia Griffiths was not the invisible other woman, neither in Rochester nor in the wider world of abolitionism. As Douglas made his ideological turn to political anti-slavery and underwent a bitter breakup with Garrison and his organization, she became part of the target of retribution. The split reached a full-blown stage in 1851, as Douglas openly embraced Smith's version of an anti-slavery interpretation of the Constitution, of voting, and political activism. As Smith mentored Douglas through this transformation, Julia tempered her colleague's anger and guided and prodded him through the bloodletting he encountered from and delivered to the Garrisonians. Douglas's course was typical of that of the many abolitionists who came to see political action as essential to their cause. Although he had long expressed gratitude for Garrison's tutelage and patronage, the great Bostonian had become the father to leave behind. Douglas had long since headed out for his own new territory. The rigid doctrines of disunionism, non-voting, and moral suasion no longer sufficed in the political climate of the 1850s, especially in the wake of the Fugitive Slave Act and the violent unfolding of the crisis over slavery's western expansion. Non-voting and disunionism were the easiest of Garrisonian tenets for Douglas to discard. The meaning of slavery in relation to federal law proved more problematic. The Smith Circle's view held that the Constitution empowered, even required, Congress to abolish slavery in the southern states by direct legislation. Pioneered by the New York abolitionist Alvin Stewart, this argument gained wider adherence from the writings of William Goodell and Lysander Spooner in the 1840s. Douglas read these authors and slowly came under their sway. The Garrisonians would claim that Douglas turncoated only for Smith's donations and out of selfish ambition. But he was drawn to new ideas that offered him hope in killing the power of slavery. Goodell and Spooner pointed to constitutional guarantees of habeas corpus and a republican form of government for every state. The preamble's call for a more perfect union and promise to secure the blessings of liberty, the enabling clause, and especially the Fifth Amendment's declaration that no person could be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, as proof that the federal government was obligated to abolish slavery everywhere. Especially as an editor, Douglas had always engaged with national politics. Now, the federal authority at the base of slavery's stranglehold on America became his intensive focus. The Goodell-Spooner anti-slavery constitutional theory differed markedly from that championed by the Ohioan Salmon P. Chase. From the early 1840s, Chase argued that the intentions of the Founding Fathers were for a speedy abolition of slavery. He believed that slavery was a creature of state law, and therefore merely local in America. The federal government had the power, Chase maintained, to end slavery in all places where it had exclusive jurisdiction, the District of Columbia and the territories. Hence, the duty of abolitionists was to restrict, to cordon off slavery, and to try with pressure over time to convince the southern states to emancipate their slaves by state action. In the 1850s, Chase's view became the basis of the Republican Party's doctrine of free soil and non-extensionism. Thus, Douglas caught the scent of a potent idea. That constitutional principle could be elevated above constitutional practice and affect real power. He learned a new cast of mind, political philosophy as well as